This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
And in fairness to John, I mean, there's a bit of a gap between our core players and that push from the bottom from a depth standpoint. I think we lacked some of that this year, and it showed in the results.
That's new Vancouver Canucks president Trevor Linden talking about why he chose to dismiss John Tortorella after one season on a five-year coach's contract. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290, online at tsn1290.ca. Ezzy, have you spoken to Torts to commiserate with him?
I feel bad for Torts. He obviously didn't get the season that he wanted out of his team, and he had a tough year. I haven't had a chance to talk to him, but I got to say that I feel for him. I feel bad for him. And I hope that he gets a job possibly on the TSN panel, or maybe gets another head coaching job. But you know, I don't take any joy in him losing his job, because I think he was ready to really put his stamp on that team. And I know that.
Are you joking or serious?
I know that there's all the joking, the history aside, but you know, I think it's unfortunate. Things really went bad in Vancouver, and I think that hopefully he bounces back and gets another head coaching job. We'll see.
I don't think he's getting another head coaching job for a while.
Well,
now.
Not soon. I mean, the problem with John Tortorella, aside from trying to fight other coaches on Hockey Night in Canada, which is kind of a big problem, is that he coaches to a style of play that does not work in the National Hockey League anymore, and he hasn't adjusted with the times. That is the fundamental problem with John Tortorella. You know, he's brash, he does all those things, that doesn't matter. At the end of the day, results matter, and you cannot coach the way he coaches. I'm talking a style-wise, and win. You just can't.
Aside from the incident in Calgary this year, I didn't think that he was that brash or that, you know, I thought he had toned down the act a lot from his last year in New York.
Well, yes and no. You come back from the suspension and you start calling out the roster.
Well, I mean,
I don't know about that, Drew.
Fair enough. That's a fine point. You're right. Towards the end of the year.
You mentioned, Drew, that, you know, sorry to interrupt you. I mean, you mentioned that, you know, he had changed a little bit, but then you look at what happened in Calgary, and you could say that that was only one little part of the year, but I think that really was a crucial part of the year. And we saw them come into Winnipeg, and they were on that losing streak, and then Torts came back the next day. But I think that really, him losing his composure, sure, he was sticking up for his team and all that, but really, I think what was really a tell, or not a tell, but a sign, sorry, I guess that's the same thing, a little poker term.
Yeah.
A sign that this team was off the rails, like way before Roberto Luongo requested for a trade, was the struggles that the Sedins were having, that Ryan Kesler was having, that the defense was having. Is this a coincidence that all these guys had terrible years?
Well, I don't think
it is.
Well, yes, there's one thing I will say about that. You know, I guess you were quasi-defending Tortorella. One thing I will say is he took the ship as sinking. Like, he took Vancouver. That ship was sinking already. Yeah. And Vigneault went to New York, and that ship wasn't sinking.
And what did he do? he threw the anchor down.
Yeah.
He sunk it a little bit further.
So that's one thing that needs to be said, is he took a bad job.
Yeah.
That's a bad job. Window was closing, everybody knew.
Vancouver's a nice city.
You can get a tan.
He can live there for the next 4 years and make $8 million for not doing anything.
We're not sure, though, if it's $4 million and it's a half buyout. There's rumors that there's actually a kicker that they could pay out the salary, pay out the contract, and only have to pay half for both Gillis and Tortorella.
Should we? I guess we'll have to take a tag day for him and see if we can raise some money to offset the $4 million he's losing out on.
But Vigneault goes to a different team, right, guys? Like, I mean, he goes to a team on the up and up, or certainly right there. So that, you know, one thing about, oh, look at the job Vigneault does versus Tortorella. Sure. I mean, to a point, I think Vigneault's a better coach. But you also have to take into account the fact that he went to a team that was veterans getting at, you know, Vigneault didn't take that team past first round last year.
Right.
I mean, I know that Tortorella didn't take them to the first round this year, but
there's something to be said. Obviously, the Vancouver Canucks were not going to be a very good team and probably won't be a very good team for a few years now,
Another thing quickly that he does, that Vigneault does exceptionally well and Tortorella doesn't do well, Tortorella plays his players too much.
Yep.
And they wear down. No surprise to me that they wore down near the end of the season, because after December, I believe, they were right in it.
And he doesn't have
December. They had a great December.
Mm-hmm. But that's what I'm saying. And Vigneault balances the ice time. And look at the way his team flourishes. Now, I realize, see, you look at it, last year they didn't make it past first round, Vancouver. I just don't think the talent's there. But the way he manages his bench is far more in tune with what teams ought to do now if they're not doing, and Tortorella is behind the times.
I think Francesco Aquilini, and to a lesser extent Mike Gillis, because I think Aquilini was more in favor of hiring Torts.
Yeah.
I think he thought that Torts was going to come in and take a team that was a little bit soft, that had problems getting past the third round, well, winning the Stanley Cup, but lately getting past the earlier rounds. And he was going to make that team tougher, harder to play against. Mm-hmm. The only problem is this Vancouver Canucks team, the personnel is not what the New York Rangers were. There's no Ryan McDonough. No Dan Girardi.
Mm-hmm.
There's no Ryan Callahan before he was traded, obviously. Yeah. Different personalities. I think that, as Richie mentioned earlier, you look at the style of play, but also his ability to manage personalities. And that's a huge part of coaching. Yes. We've had coaches on the show before, and they talk about that. And Don Cherry was on Coach's Corner, and he's talked about this many times. You can't just manage these guys the same way you would 30 years ago. The game has changed. It's a different type of game, different type of personalities, different generation, if you want to call it that. And I think Tortorella thought that he could go into Vancouver, and he could just kind of do the same thing he did in New York. Well, you know what happened in New York? You alienated Brad Richards, and you lost your job. And that didn't go well.
That's right.
So what made him think that he could come over? And we talked to Ben Kuzma and other Vancouver writers throughout the year about, was he going to change? Well, I think we know what the answer to that was. He didn't change. And he lost his job. And I think it's going to be tough for him to get another head coaching job in the NHL. Definitely in the foreseeable future.
I agree with the foreseeable future part. Probably overall. I mean, although I bet you one team will hire him, you know, a few years down the road as, you know, trying to recapture some magic, and then he'll be found that he's a retread coach at that point in time.
I could see him getting a job if it's the NHL, maybe as an assistant.
Mike Keenan got jobs, though, guys.
Well, that's what I was going to say.
You missed the joke there.
Oh, it's
he's
on
the go. That's funny. It's clever.
Well
that's
done,
Izzy.
Well done.
Wait, God, are you guys awake?
Yeah.
No, it's 10:30 here, but let's wake up here.
I agree with you. Mike Keenan did get jobs after everyone said that he was a retread coach. And I mean, he did a good job. I don't know if he did a good job in Russia or not, but he won the KHL championship.
I mean, you do a good job if you win.
Probably.
You see him go crazy after game six in that series?
Yelling at the refs again?
He's the best.
Who do you see as the candidates for, you know, I'll open this up. Who do you see the candidates in Vancouver? They need a GM and a coach.
Okay.
And Washington, they need a GM and a coach as well right now.
Well, I good questions. I mean, we don't know who's calling the shots in Washington. It could be Gary Bettman, as Al said.
Al.
But, you know, let's start in Vancouver. The rumors are that Jim Benning, who has ties to the team and the area, all that stuff.
Trevor Linden's former teammate.
Yes, from assistant general manager in Boston, would be one of the lead candidates. So we'll go on that basis. If he is hired, then you wonder if he hires somebody from the Boston tree or something like that.
Sure.
But I don't have any great insight into it. Drew, you look at Washington, and that's a different team. I mean, can you go in there with a first-time general manager like a Brad Treliving, who I think is going to do a good job? But do you go in there with a first-time general manager and with the presence of Alexander Ovechkin there, who's had you know, Dale Hunter, now he left voluntarily, but Dale Hunter, and then you have Bruce Boudreau got fired, Adam Oates. And you could argue that Ovechkin's somewhat of a coach killer.
Mm-hmm.
And never mind, you know, McPhee leaving there now. So you have to wonder, that job I think will go to somebody who's a little bit more seasoned. It almost has to. And then you have to ask yourself, well, what's the format of the front office going to be? Is it going to be a president of hockey operations and a president of this operations and this? I mean, are there going to be four guys making decisions? Are they going to hire one general manager and he's going to hire the coach? That's another thing to ask. There's too many positions, I think, in these front offices now. So I have to wonder what Leonsis does here.
Washington's a wild card to me. I think nobody can really get a real feel for. I mean,
there are a lot of good candidates, other guys, like, you know, a guy like Jeff Gordon in New York, who's worked with Glenn Sather. He's goes under the radar. He's in a nice job. You hear, you know, Breezeball's name in Tampa Bay, but that was kind of that sexy candidate years ago.
Yeah,
and
Jason Botterill.
And Jason Botterill's another one. And Botterill, he's somebody who you could see going to Washington, but that's, again, a lot of pressure, right? He goes in, and what do you do with Ovechkin?
Well,
I'm not saying you have to trade Ovechkin, but how do you?
I think that has to be on the table.
I agree, that has to be on the table.
It really does at this point.
I agree.
Why should it not be on the table?
Can you put another rookie coach in Washington? I mean, he's gone through. Look how many rookie coaches Ovechkin's gone through.
Adam Oates was a rookie coach, but he was an assistant with the Devils.
Everybody's an assistant, though.
I'm just saying. I mean, Sure, you're right. You make a good point. Should it be someone with NHL head coaching experience?
The question is who?
Well, there's talk Ron Wilson might go back.
Oh, God, Ron Wilson. Ron Wilson couldn't coach himself out of a paper bag.
I think when you're talking about Vancouver and Washington, Barry Trotz has to come up right away.
Yeah, and we've totally agreed.
We've talked about Josh Cooper.
Totally agree.
The Vancouver province had a list of 11 for the Vancouver head coaching job. And I think, by the way, that these guys... Just quickly, I think some of these guys, I won't name them all, but some of these guys would be probably applicable to both John Stevens, who is someone who almost was hired before Tortorella, Todd McClellan, if he's fired by the San Jose Sharks,
apparently
could
Vancouver,
be an option.
Dave Pollock, who we're having on later in the show, said Vancouver really likes McClellan.
Kevin Dineen is another guy. We mentioned Trotz. If Kirk Muller, that's another guy. If they don't keep him there, he's another option. Guy Boucher has been coaching in Switzerland. It's different now than it was during the regular season when there wasn't a lot of options. Now that some of the coaches have lost their jobs and other coaches that have had success in other leagues are starting to pop up, I mean, there's some good coaches out there right now.
It'll be an interesting offseason, as it always is in the NHL, and we'll bring it all to you here on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Let's head to break. When we come back, we head out to Calgary. George Johnson from the Calgary Herald joins us to talk about the Flames' new general manager. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
Shortly past 10:30 in the morning, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets, NHL, and Stanley Cup playoff news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
We are pleased to welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show our good friend from the Calgary Herald, George Johnson. George, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
No problem.
George, obviously the Calgary Flames finally hired their general manager earlier this week, with it being Brad Treliving coming over from the Phoenix Coyotes organization. How surprised were you that Brian Burke did choose Brad Treliving to be the GM?
Well, I was quite frankly shocked. And that has nothing to do with Brad. He's one of those guys that, you know, you just kind of flies under the radar and you know, did a lot of work at Phoenix with Don Maloney and really didn't have a huge profile outside of the inner hockey circle. But we all kind of figured Brian would just go, he'd go familiar, he'd go recycle, he'd go, you know, somebody that he knew and that he had actually worked with, because he can be a difficult man, as we all know. So when this sort of came out of the blue, I think everybody was shocked and quite pleasantly surprised, actually.
George, Brian Burke admitted that Brad Treliving was the only candidate that he interviewed for that general manager job. Were you, I mean, I guess not surprised, but did he do himself a disservice by not interviewing a few other candidates?
Well, I don't know. I mean, interviewing is one thing. Talking to guys and seeing if they're interested, I would think, was another. We know that he talked to Joe Nieuwendyk a long time ago before they had their thing forever aflame for Joe here, and Joe admitted that he had talked to Brian, you know, just, you know, cursory discussions about the job, about what it would entail and stuff. And Joe decided it wasn't for him right now. He had a young family and he wanted to spend more time with it, et cetera, et cetera. So interviewing and poking around to see if someone's interested, I think, are two very different things.
George, you know, this new structure of management we're seeing in the National Hockey League, and half the time, frankly, I can't figure out who's actually making the decisions.
It's kind of a too many cooks spoil the broth kind of thing.
It's exactly right. And so in this case, who do you think is going to be making the decisions?
Well, I think that ultimately, you know, Brad said the other day when he had his introductory press conference, he says, ultimately, I have a boss, just like I have a boss and you have a boss, and Brian's his boss. And I think that Brian, after talking, having extensive talks with him and talking to other people about around the league, felt that Brad was a guy who at least shared most of his vision for where this franchise should go. So, you know, when you think about it, maybe that means that they'll have a better focus, one kind of a look going forward. You would hope that would be the case. But I think ultimately, as with all Brian Burke hockey teams, the buck stops with Brian Burke. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Our guest is George Johnson from the Calgary Herald, as we talk about the Flames' hiring of Brad Treliving as their new general manager. And George, you know, Don Maloney in Phoenix gave Treliving a glowing review. They spent a lot of time together, obviously, there. How much do you think his time in Phoenix with such a strapped budget and such a limited budget will help him in the Calgary position?
Well, you know, I think Brian's right in it, at least. I've never run a hockey team, so I don't know. But Brian said in hiring him, he said, you know what, when somebody has to sort of go through what they did in Phoenix, when you have to watch every nickel, when you have to, you know, make sure that all your decisions are right ones, that creates good habits. And, I mean, this has been, until recently when they started pairing off the, you know, Iginla and Kiprasov retired and they started offloading some guys, this was a cap team. Brad Treliving has never had that luxury, obviously, in the 7 years that he had in Phoenix. But he has the right focus, and he has the right sort of instincts in what will make, you know, a good fit and what is a good price and all that kind of thing. And I think that helps this organization going forward, even as they say that they will be a cap team again at some point.
George, Flames general manager Brian Burke announced after the...
President of Hockey Operations.
Sorry, President of Hockey Operations, my bad. That was a...
All right. We're all used to saying it. Yeah,
Freudian slip here. Brian Burke announced after the regular season, of course, that Bob Hartley would return to coach the Calgary Flames. Where do you think Bob Hartley stands now that the Flames have hired Brad Treliving as their GM?
I think he starts. I don't think there's any question about that. And it's funny, we were talking about it kicking around in the Saddle Dome parking lot where we seem to have spent most of our formative lives these last 30 years. But if you look back at it, we were trying to figure out when was the last time that Calgary Flames gave a coach an extension on his contract. And if you scroll back, way back, and all, you know, to when I basically started, the guy we came up with was Bob Johnson.
Wow.
Now, that's a long time ago, and that's a lot of guys ago. Terry Crisp won a Stanley Cup. He only got 3 years. Doug Risebrough only got a few years. Daryl kicked himself upstairs, so I guess you could put an asterisk beside that. But he only had the one coaching gig here. So it's not like they've had a lot of continuity in the coaching department in this organization over the years. And, you know, I think that Bob did a heck of a job last year, you know, squeezing blood out of a turnip. I think he deserves another shot. They haven't said a word about an extension, so I think probably he's still on audition for the new general manager in the year coming up. And it will be more difficult for this team next year because all of a sudden people will expect something of them. Last year, everything was just you're playing with house money, you know, at the casino. Everything you did good was wonderful, and everything you did bad was, well, you know, they're the Flames, right? So next year there's going to be a little bit of an expectation put on this team. People are going to expect them to move forward. People are going to expect them to be better points-wise and win-wise, and that'll really put the onus on Bob Hartley to squeeze even more blood out of the turnip.
Yeah, George, what about Ken King? Now you have Treliving there, you have Brian Burke. Some say that Ken King was maybe calling the shots far too much, and hockey-related shots, or at least, you know, in the big-picture ones in the past. Yeah. What's his role now?
Well, it's funny because, you know, Ken has always been, and Ken used to be my boss at the Calgary Sun way back when. Ken was a very kind of a, at least downstairs in the lower bowl, kind of peripheral figure last year, which we weren't used to him being. I think with Brian there, it's Brian's show, and Brian's not going to take any hoodoo from anybody. So I think that I think that they want a new rink. There's no question, and I think, and that's just my guess, more and more of Ken's energies will be put towards trying to move that forward right now than the day-to-day hockey operations, which he says he had no part in before, but which we still wondered about. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. We're joined by George Johnson, columnist with the Calgary Herald, talking about the front office changes in Calgary. George, you know, another organizational change that's happening, you know, it's sort of under the radar, is that the Flames are moving their farm team from Abbotsford, BC to Glen Falls, New York this coming year. You know, what was behind the move of the team seemingly a lot further away from Calgary than Abbotsford previously was?
I don't know. They do with farm teams. They just seem to be like Elizabeth Taylor was with husbands. You know, I mean, it just there seems to be a new one pop up every day, and it seems to be going to be the greatest fit, and it's going to be a union that lasts forever, and they wind up in divorce court. You know, it does. It's kind of mystifying. I mean, we talk about coaches coming and going here. Well, farm teams have certainly come and gone here. I remember going back to camps out in Moncton, for crying out loud, of the farm team, and they've had them. Salt Lake City was Theo Fleury's farm team of choice for a while. They've been all over the place, and it's weird. But I mean, if you look at it, only one team, I think it was Portland, had a lower average attendance than the Abbotsford Heat. Obviously, they weren't getting the people that they thought they could get into the stands in Abbotsford. And so they've decided to pull up stakes again and head off in Glen Falls, New York, which seems to be, you might as well be in Paris or Bangkok, for crying out loud, for the, you know, the amount of time you can get guys in here, seems to be the hot rumor right now. So I think we're all as mystified as you are here. The Abbotsford thing didn't work out, but, you know, they just don't seem to be able to pick their marriage partners very well.
George, we'd be remiss if we didn't ask you about longtime play-by-play broadcaster.
The greatest,
Peter Marr, who retired earlier this week. Can you put into, for those who aren't familiar with him, can you put into words what Peter Marr has meant to the city of Calgary?
Well, you know, it's funny. We're kicking around the other day when Pete's farewell press conference. I mean, he's been here from the beginning. He didn't do play-by-play the first year the team was here. A guy named Bart Daly did. But Pete was on the broadcast. So he, and the second year, he started being the play-by-play man, and he's been the play-by-play man ever since. So we're talking 34 years. And, you know, you got to remember, you guys being really young and me being, you know, like Methuselah here, you got to remember that back in the day when this team was really good and it was really hot, there was no social media, there was no TSN, there was the voice of the Calgary Flames was Peter Marr. And that's how you knew the Calgary Flames. Not every road game was televised. Not every home game was televised. So you got it through Pete, the way the old Leaf fans used to get it through, you know, Bill Hewitt, and the Canadiens fans got it through Danny Gallivan, and the St. Louis Blues fans got it through, Dan Kelly. And Pete's the last, you know, not the last, because there's still a lot of them. Chucky Caton's around, and there's quite a few of those guys still left, but, you know, 34 years on one job is pretty amazing, and he's as famous as any player. Locally, he's as famous as any player that's ever come through here. So it's a big hole. Not having Pete at camp in September is going to be seismically different.
George Johnson is a columnist with the Calgary Herald. He covers the Calgary Flames. He's a great guest here on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. George, thanks very much for doing this morning.
No problem. I'm going out to shovel.
Yeah, I saw it snowing in Calgary. Just
oh, man, is it coming down. I might as well be living on Westwood Drive again.
I say, just leave it there. Don't bring it west. Don't bring it further east. We don't want it here in Winnipeg.
Okay, we'll try and keep it here.
Thanks, George. Take care, bud.
Good shoveling, George.
Let's head to break. Before we do, a reminder that this segment was brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, the official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey. Conveniently located at Cordon and Lanark in the Cordon Village Mall, Bernstein's is a family-owned and operated traditional-style deli. Take at home or eat in their full-service restaurant, Bernstein's Deli has been Winnipeg's deli destination for nearly 30 years. For more information, find them on Facebook or at bernsteinsdeli.com.
You're listening to The Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
10 minutes before the top of the hour. Welcome back. to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Big thank you to George Johnson of the Calgary Herald for just joining us. In case you missed any of that interview, it will be available for download on iTunes, on TSN1290.ca, and on our website, IllegalCurve.com. This segment is brought to you by Dr. Les Rikus and the Linden Market Dental Center. Whether an elite athlete or a weekend warrior, an essential part of your protective equipment is a proper fitting, custom-made mouth guard. Give yourself peace of mind protection as well as facial, teeth, and mouth protection. Contact the Linden Market Dental Center at 204-487-2226 or online at lindenmarketdentalcenter.com. Gentlemen, the final series to get underway will do so finally. That was a mouthful. Tonight at 7 p.m. on TSN as the Los Angeles Kings and the Anaheim Ducks will face off in the division final, the Pacific Division final, I guess, as it is. The first ever matchup, playoff matchup, between two teams from Los Angeles in any sport, baseball, I guess it could be football too, between the Rams and the LA Raiders, and of course basketball between the Clippers and the Lakers. The first ever one tonight between the Kings and the Ducks. To me, of all the teams left in the playoffs, one of the teams that scares me the most right now is the Los Angeles Kings. It seems that, you know, you see it so often in sports that, you know, just when a team is right at the brink of being eliminated, or they squeak by and they narrowly dodge at their season ending, it seems like that's always the team that can then get on a roll and can become a juggernaut that makes it further than they would have had they, you know, just sort of defeated the San Jose Sharks in 6 games or 7 games, as opposed to coming back from that historic 3-0 deficit. How do you see this series between the Kings and the Ducks?
Well, I don't think you ever underestimate the heart of a champion, Drew, and I think that's what LA demonstrated in that series. And Mike Richards didn't play well, I thought, for the majority of the series. I thought Game 7 he played really well. You had guys, Drew Doughty, I mean, just a dominant player. Jonathan Quick, dominant player. Daryl Sutter, terrific coach. You know, terrible general manager, but as bad as he was as a general manager, and I thought he was pretty bad. It wasn't that bad, but he was pretty bad. He's as, you know, just as opposite. He's great, just as good as a coach. He's an unbelievable coach. Motivation is one of the key factors, one of the key assets and attributes that he brings to the table. Now, this is the thing. This is a very tough series. Anaheim is very much like San Jose, but with a little bit better goaltending, probably. And I think with two key differences, okay? And those differences are Getzlaf and Perry. Because Anaheim's big boys come to play in the playoffs, and San Jose's guys go and they hide in the closet. That's the difference. So if LA had trouble with Anaheim, with San Jose, which they did, the first 3 games were, guys, I mean, they weren't close the first 3 games.
No, beat them by 3, 4, 5 goal margins.
And so Anaheim brings a lot of the same things to the table. They have, you know, maybe not as much overall forward talent, but they have better top-end talent. They get in on the forecheck, and they have speed. And they have guys that know their roles. I think LA is going to have their handfuls here. I like LA in the series, but I think LA is going to go to 7 with Anaheim. And I think LA comes out of the series, play Chicago, and similar to last year, I don't think LA is going to be able to keep up with Chicago. So, but in terms of this series, Drew, the goaltending, and as the goaltending is a huge factor here. Anderson and Hiller, we don't know who it's going to be. Both guys aren't as good as Jonathan Quick. Then you look at the defense. You know, Willie Mitchell will be missed, sure. I like the way Alec Martinez played in the first round, by the way. His speed will be helpful. Skating will be helpful against Anaheim. But when you look at, you know, Drew Doughty, does Anaheim have anybody who can beat Drew Doughty? You know, there's no Duncan Keith on the other side there, okay? Mm-hmm. Good defense as a whole. I like and they have good depth, but no top-end guys. And then you look at the rest of the rosters. I mean, LA's second lines and a little bit more depth on the top end. If Kopitar can match Getzlaf, LA's going to win this series. I think there's other ways LA wins, but Getzlaf has to outplay Kopitar by a considerable margin. And Kopitar is going to play well. And he's really good defensively, too. Getzlaf's got to be dominant in this series from the outset.
Right, and I think that this series is really, to me, almost too close to call. I think this is going to 7 games, absolutely. And the Anaheim Ducks, I don't think, played as well as they could have in that first round against the Dallas Stars. They had a lot of problems against the Dallas Stars in that first round, more so than I thought they would have. And they were only averaging, I think, 27 or 28 shots a game, which is low for the Anaheim Ducks. Richie mentioned, you know, the top-end players. Yes, Getzlaff and Perry are better than almost every team in the NHL's top players, with the exception of maybe two or three teams. But for the Los Angeles Kings, the name of the game is physicality. And when they came back into that series, you saw forwards like Mike Richards and Dustin Brown using what is really their bread and butter. And that's playing physical hockey, finishing your checks, being tenacious. Jonathan Quick is a better goaltender than Frederik Andersen, who was pulled twice in the Anaheim-Dallas series. As Richie mentioned, we're not sure who's going to start in that game. Really, if you match up every aspect of the game, you could probably only give the edge to the Anaheim Ducks as far as forwards go, and then maybe special teams, but
not even really. Like
the LA Kings right now, for a team that has come back from down three games, they're the favorite in this series. And I think, yeah, sure, there's the storylines are abundant with this is the first time these two teams have ever played. The reality is, to get to the Chicago Blackhawks in the Western Conference Finals, you have to go through the LA Kings now. And the LA Kings continue to be a team that is built for playoff hockey. And yes, they were dominated in San Jose those first two games, and then the third game they lost in overtime. But the San Jose Sharks, I mean, they choked, and we're going to talk to David Pollock about that. They should have won that series. I'm not taking anything away from the LA Kings, but when you're up 3-0, you got to lock that down. You just have to.
And that was a choke job of epic proportions.
The LA Kings deserve all the credit in the world because their best players started to perform. Mike Richards was really struggling in those first three or four games, even the fourth game, and then he came along and he started being a leader that we've always expected him to be. The LA Kings are one of the best defensive teams in the NHL, if not the best defensive team in the NHL, and that's going to cause some problems. The Anaheim Ducks are going to have to stay out of the penalty box, and they're going to have to really match that physicality, and not just match it, Richie, but manage it. Because the LA Kings have some players, and you can throw out other guys like Jordan Nolan. Jake Muzzin is a great physical defenseman. I've been praising him for a long time now. I really think he's an underrated defenseman. You know, Richie mentioned some of the other guys. Sure, they don't move maybe as fast as they can, but Slava Voyanov is an excellent defenseman. We saw how good he was when they won the Cup in 2012. I mean, the LA Kings, we said this, they were much better than the sixth-ranked team in the West. I mean, we saw what they did here in Winnipeg. They dominated the Jets. They're a really good team. So I think that when you look at this series, it's going to be really close, and I think this is going to be the equivalent of the Chicago-St. Louis series. I think we're going to see three or four overtimes. I like the Kings to win, but I've tried really hard to pick the Ducks in my mind or in the analysis, but I think the equalizer is the way Jonathan Quick has started to play, and they look like the team that they were in 2012. I think they're going to give the Ducks a lot of problems.
You know, I think that Anaheim's, I mean, obviously Getzlaff and Perry are the, I think they're the best two forwards in the series. I think they're better than LA's top guys. But after that, you know,
Kopitar's in that conversation. But after that, there's,
yeah, I mean, Kopitar's in that conversation.
Carter's right below there.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah. I think, you know, I'll take Getzlaff and Perry over Kopitar and Carter on my
team. Yes, yes.
Well, they've got some good young forwards. I'm a big fan of Tyler Toffoli. I really like Tanner Pearson.
Well,
young players that at the end of the series they start. Toffoli got a couple goals.
No, they totally changed the series.
Yeah.
Tanner Pearson was an in-game one. Yep. Tanner Pearson impressed me.
He's a former Barry Colt.
Yeah, well, he was great. And then you look at Toffoli and Ezzie. Good point, because those two guys changed the series, in my opinion. I know I realize there's other things that they did, moving Dustin Brown up, and I think changing some of the ice time wise, and obviously Jonathan Quick playing well. That was the big key, and some issues and some changes they made in terms of strategy. But at the end of the day, those youthful guys who are able to create offense, which they needed to do, and add some element, you know, Pearson adding a nice speed element there, was critical to LA coming back.
Well, those guys are rookies and they're young, but they're not green. I mean, they've had so much experience in Manchester playing for the AHL team. I mean, it was about a month ago, 5 weeks ago, we had Nelson Emerson, the Kings director of player personnel, on the team. And he says, you know,
on the show,
and he said, you know, our young guys are just, they're champing at the bit to get their opportunity, but we're not going to, they don't, you know, they have to earn it and they have to go through the wars in the AHL before they're ready to break through that glass ceiling.
And this is
why now we might be seeing those guys, you know, they took a big step that last series, and we're going to see if they can continue even just staying at that level that they played at last series. It's going to be hard for Anaheim to control those guys.
Just a couple things quickly. I think back to what we were talking about. We weren't sure if Frederik Andersen or Jonas Hiller is going to get the start tonight. One of those guys has to step up and take that role, regardless of who it is, because both of those guys have had struggles. We mentioned that Andersen has sat twice, or sorry, not sat, been pulled twice in the first round. The other thing, too, is I look at the LA Kings and what they got out of the San Jose Sharks in terms of them taking penalties. If Corey Perry is going to retaliate like he did against the Dallas Stars, because look what happened with Ryan Garbutt. Ryan Garbutt might have been fine there, but Ryan Garbutt, they know the strategy, and you look at what the Blue Jackets did with Sidney Crosby. You got to get under the skin of a guy like Corey Perry, even a Getzlaf, but Getzlaf is able to control himself. Perry gets really into, he lets his emotions take over. A guy like Perry, the only way I can see the Ducks really taking over the series or winning, because I do think I could easily see the Ducks winning the series. I think it's going to go down to the wire.
I can't.
He's going to have to keep his emotions in check and not. Corey Perry's 27 years old now. He's got to get that stuff out of his game and stop retaliating. And I think guys like Dustin Brown and I think guys like Jordan Nolan and even Mike Richards are going to try to get him to get into the penalty box. And we know what happens if you're in the penalty box. You can't score. So that's a key to the series for me.
I just think the series is one on the boards. I think LA wins in seven, but I think it's a tight series. And Getzlaf and Perry will be the difference. If Anaheim wins, they will have to get. They will get. If Anaheim wins, Getzlaf and Perry will post at least 8 points each in this series.
Let's head to break. When we come back, we'll talk about the San Jose Sharks' collapse against the LA Kings in round one. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
We're down to 17 seconds left in the season for the Sharks, and what a horrible disappointment this is for everybody.
A horrible disappointment.
Is that our boy Dan Rusinowski?
I believe it would be, yes. And it might be even an understatement, and it's hard to believe that horrible disappointment can be an understatement, but that's how you got to feel if you're a member of the San Jose Sharks organization or if you're a fan of that team. Up 3-0 against the Los Angeles Kings, and the epic collapse was completed in that defeat in Game 7. And you know what the most surprising thing is? When it was 3-0... You know, did you really feel 100% confident that San Jose was not going to roll over?
Yeah. Mostly, Drew, if you watch the first three games, as I said, they weren't close. They weren't remotely close, especially games, I mean, 1 and 2. And I know Marlowe's game 3 overtime winner, but that was a little more close. And 4 and 7 were close. There's so many aspects of this. If I'm a San Jose fan, it's the way my team opened Game 5. That would be the most disconcerting aspect of this collapse to me. Tom McClellan basically threw it on the line. If you listen to his, he had an interview with Scott Oak, who is a great interviewer. He had an interview with Scott Oak right before Game 5, basically saying, last year, you know, we didn't take advantage of opportunity, or in the past, we haven't taken advantage of opportunities to close out series early, and I think that's hurt us going deep. And yeah, that's being very forthright. And basically saying, you know, we need to take care of this today. They come out in Game 5, and LA just dominated the first period of Game 5. It wasn't even close. It was a clinic, and I know LA scored almost early in almost every game in the series, but that beginning of Game 5, it's like, where are you, San Jose? That's a no-show. You know you're going back to LA if you lose 3-2, and you're going to lose in LA, likely. And goal controversy aside, another disconcerting aspect if I'm a San Jose fan is Game 6. Tie game. Controversial goal. What happens right after? 2 more goals. Because you're mentally weak. You have Joe Thornton and Patrick Marleau for all the stats and all that stuff that they bring to the table. When it matters most, and Marleau's has won 2 Olympic gold medals in a complimentary role. Okay, he's not a complimentary player on this team. Joe Thornton won one and won the... I don't remember if Marleau's on the World Cup team. In any event, none of these guys have ever been the guy on a winning team. At the top level of hockey. And you've signed them to 3-year deals, and you're expecting something different? Joe Thornton, he didn't have a point in the last 4 games. Did he?
I don't believe so.
He didn't have a point. Well, did you watch him play?
He played like Joe Thornton plays.
Mm-hmm.
Detached, unemotional.
It was after game 4 or 5. CBC's panel was on, and Elliot Friedman mentioned that they were showing the post-game interview with Joe Thornton. And Joe was, you know, you got to like Joel. I mean, Joe, class act and all that stuff. So I'll relax. You know, we didn't play a good game. And Elliot Friedman pointed out the fact that he thought that was great to see that Joe Thornton was calm. And I disagreed with that. And I thought Craig Simpson put it well. He said, isn't that the problem? Isn't that the big problem? He's always like that. And I know he's fought Getzlaff in the past and series and all that stuff, but that just seems kind of unnatural for him. And I'm not just pinning it all on Joe Thornton. I mean, I've said before, I didn't think this defense was good enough for them to make a run. I thought they'd beat L.A.
And then they lose Vlasic.
Right? Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I didn't think it was good enough to beat Chicago or Boston, really. And that's an issue. And then depth on the back end is an issue, too. But forget the depth. They dropped Matt Irwin and he scored a goal. It's overall, I didn't love their back end. And then it's a goalie thing. And I thought Todd McClellan mishandled that. And I'm going on a long rant here, as I'll let you get in a second. Todd McClellan comes into the series, doesn't declare a starter, then says it's Niemi, then goes to Stalock in Game 6, and then goes back to Niemi in Game 7. So he's not good enough to play in Game 6. What's the difference? You want both games are equally important to you.
They're all elimination games.
You win or you're out. You win and you're on. I realize that you have one extra game after Game 6. I can do math. But the point is, you basically said to Niemi, you're not good enough to play Game 6 closeout series in L.A. And then they lose Game 6, and you're saying, well, you're good enough to win Game 7 in a must-win.
And you know what they have?
Come on!
They had the chances in Game 7. What, they have four power plays in the second period?
You know, that's great. Go talk about chances at home.
Look, I'm saying that the opportunity, if they were a good enough team, the it was sitting there for them, and LA said, okay, you guys dropped the ball. You had four power play opportunities. You couldn't get it done. Instead, we'll just, you don't want to win good. You don't want to win bad enough. We'll go take the win.
And they don't have composure under pressure. Did you watch them? We watched the game together, Izzy. At the end of the game, when they had those power plays at the end of the game, they were so nervous, they couldn't complete a pass.
Yeah. The reality is it shouldn't have got to the Game 7. It shouldn't have got to that Game 7. And you're right. And, you know, Richie mentions their leaders, their veterans, the guys that have been there for a long time now, Marleau more so than Thornton. But we're talking Marleau and Thornton, two excellent players. Richie mentioned Marleau was an Olympian this past time and Thornton was last time. Pardon me, 2010 I meant. Marleau in 2014. But when you look at those guys...
Marleau and both.
Right? And what happened in Game 7, Marleau had that great chance and Jonathan Quick made the save. Remember, they had to review it. And his glove was kind of on the line there. It was a terrific save. Jonathan Quick, to me, really was the reason why they were able to come back. The 5-1 score, I thought, there was the empty net goal.
Right.
But it was a little bit more flattering to the LA Kings. But I think that game was telling in the sense that after those power plays in the second period, they couldn't get it done. They kind of buckled. And then LA took the lead. And they couldn't come back. And that third period, that was difficult to watch. Mm-hmm. It was depressing to watch the San Jose Sharks in that last period when they were out of it. And Richie mentioned in those first few games, I was saying, wow, like,
juggernaut.
Exactly. And you never want to say, okay, it's after two games. You don't want to say, wow, this team looks good. But I was watching this team and I was saying, okay,
like, and seven we talked, goals against Jonathan Quick,
seven goals. How many teams, I should say, if I can get my words out of my mouth here, how many teams scored more than three goals on Jonathan Quick? Jonathan Quick's one of the best goaltenders in the league, if not the best. And the way he played in Game 7 against San Jose, I think you could probably argue that he is the best. You don't score a lot of goals on him. But Richie mentioned what's unfortunate for these guys like Joe Thornton and Patrick Marleau is they're not going to get a lot more chances with this team to go to a Stanley Cup. Like, how many more first-round exits are left for this team?
Where was Logan Couture this series?
Wasn't there. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, there was one guy who was dominant and everybody else, let him down. The whole team, it was a whole team collapse. It was impressive. You don't see 20 guys really commit to collapsing
I agree with Richie.
As well as the Sharks did.
The one last thing I want to say, I agree with Richie with the goaltending. You can't go to Stalock late in the series like that. You can't do that.
What are you doing?
It's a panic move.
It's a panic move.
You can't do that.
It's a panic
move. And I like Tom McClellan as a head coach. And I think we've learned from Washington, a lot of the times the coach isn't always a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't like that decision.
Before we head to break, a reminder that this segment was brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, the longest-running independent comedy club in North America. For over 25 years, Rumors has been Winnipeg's home for the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets or for a list of performers and showtimes, visit rumorscomedyclub.com. Tonight at Rumors, Shane Moss in town for two shows. You can check him out, buy tickets at rumorscomedyclub.com. Let's head to break. When we come back, we're going to bring in David Pollock from the San Jose Mercury News to talk more about the Sharks collapse. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to
The Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Welcome back to The Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN1290, TSN1290.ca. Follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets, NHL, and Stanley Cup playoff news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show our good friend from the San Jose Mercury News, waking up nice and early for us, David Pollock. David, good morning. Thanks very much for doing this.
You're welcome. Good morning.
David, obviously, sort of it's a straightforward first question, but we got to ask it. How did this happen? How did the Sharks collapse from a three-game-to-none lead to losing the series in seven games?
Well, Doug Wilson's going to take about 2 weeks to try to figure out the answer, but I don't know how I'm going to be able to give it to you 2 days later. The easy answer is their top line stopped producing. The last three games, the Sharks got two goals, one from Matt Irwin, the other from James Shepard. And as Wilson himself said, no disrespect to those two guys, but you're not going to win a hockey game with those guys being your only scorers for three games.
You know, David, you look at the coaching, and Tom McClellan's pretty well regarded. You've written about the fact that Vancouver likes him, and if he were to be let go, there'd certainly be a possibility of him landing somewhere quite quickly. Who should bear responsibility for this? I mean, do you think at the end of the day, this is a Doug Wilson issue, this is a McClellan issue, or this is a player's issue?
I think it's probably all three. I mean, it's the pattern there has been in place. I mean, Doug Wilson does a good job of getting a hockey team that's going to get into the playoffs, that's going to keep the fan base satisfied, and they're selling out the building. The question is, what's keeping things from getting to the next level, and where does the solution lie? And I'm really interested because a lot of the National Hockey writers have been cautioning. They've been saying basically, don't do anything hasty in San Jose. You've got a good team in place there as far as the management team and the coaching team and the players. Don't be too crazy over this thing. And yet here there's this incredible demand. Mm-hmm. Somebody's got to take the fall. Somebody's got to do something here. And Doug told us yesterday his recommendation to ownership is that the coaching staff not take the fall, that those guys, you know, bring them back for another year. Ultimately, the decision rests with ownership, and it'll be interesting to see if that recommendation is upheld.
David, you mentioned ownership, and Sharks owner, of course, as you know, is Hasso Plattner, and I know this was written about by your colleague in the San Jose Mercury News. He's been pretty low-key during his time as the Sharks' majority owner. Do you think we're about to hear more from him or learn more about him as he ponders these major organizational changes?
Probably not. I've actually sent him a couple emails trying to see if I can prod him enough to get a response and see if we can have that conversation. That hasn't happened yet. He was pretty, you know, the one time he met with us, he talked with a couple of us for like 45 minutes when he took over the reins of ownership. He's been in the deep pockets, heavily invested owner for a long time, but he finally became the guy who was going to be making the real decisions on a regular basis just about a year and a half ago. And at the time he told us, you're not going to hear from me. I'm not going to be the kind of owner that I don't believe in dealing with the media. And I said, well, what if I've got a question about the people you want me to talk to, like Doug Wilson? And he said, if you ask me about Doug Wilson, I'll say, we're looking into everything. We know that he's doing a fine job. So he's basically telling me, don't come looking to me for any kind of a comment because you're not going to get a sincere one.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. We're joined by David Pollock of the San Jose Mercury News talking about the Sharks' collapse. David, you look at the Sharks organization, you look at their year, and they re-signed Joe Thornton, they re-signed Patrick Marleau during the course of the season. The one guy they didn't re-sign was Dan Boyle. He becomes an unrestricted free agent on June the 30th. You know, what does the future hold for Dan Boyle in your mind?
If you had to, you know, somebody put a gun to my head and said, well, is he going to be with the Sharks next year? I think my answer would be, I don't think so. Dan is looking, and so far hasn't wavered from the fact he's looking for more than a one-year deal. He feels that he's got, you know, enough time left in him that, he actually told us yesterday, I'm not looking for three or four, so obviously he's looking for a two-year contract. The Sharks, on the other hand, from what I've been led to believe, they don't mind having Dan Boyle for the next 2 years, but they don't want to go to a 2 year deal. That there is a CBA provision, which I wish I understood better, that gives them incentive for players over 35 to sign them to 1 year deals as far as what they can do with cap money down the road. that comes into play. And I think there's probably also a little bit of concern about, is Dan still, you know, the same Dan Boyle that they've relied on so long? Dan, you know, knows that he took a lot of criticism this year for most of the season. He feels he ended it strong that the last month of the season, and if you look at his numbers, they were up, and that during the playoff, he was, you know, closer to the player he was before he had that bad hit in October from LaPierre of the Blues.
David, I mean, we talked about players, specifically Joe Thornton and Marlowe. They signed their contracts, as Drew just mentioned, three-year deals, both with no move clauses, but I mean, Joe Thornton, a lot of respect for the guy, and I'm sure you were in the scrum, I think it was after game five or six, seemed very relaxed with the status of the team, and to me, it didn't seem as, he's just not going to be that urgent guy. You can't change, you know, his nature. They have re-signed him, so I mean, is he locked into San Jose for sure, and if so, can they win with him there as the main guy?
Yeah, I think he's pretty locked in here. I mean, Doug Wilson will tell you, not talking about Joe Thornton specifically, but that there are ways to work out no movement clauses and no trade clauses. They aren't necessarily permanent obstacles. And in Dan Boyle's case, for example, coming from Tampa, when the Sharks acquired him, he had a no movement clause there, but they made his life a living hell, so he basically finally said, okay, get me out of here. And not that I'm saying Doug Wilson's going to do the same thing to Thornton or Marlowe, but there are ways to navigate around those things. I think Thornton is here, and let me just sort of throw this two cents worth in. The side of Joe that he wants to present is the very calm, everything's under control, you're not going to see a lot of fire there very often. I see enough of Joe that I think there is definitely another side that the guys in the room get and that the coaching staff gets, that there really is more passion than he wants to let on. And I don't know if you saw him after the Game 7. He was fairly choked up. I mean, this happened a few years back when they were eliminated by Anaheim in the first round when the Sharks were the President's Trophy team. Joe didn't meet with the media that night. And when I talked to him like 2 days later at the cleanout, he basically said, you know, everybody thought that was kind of a cowardly act. But Joe basically said a couple days later, it was, I couldn't deal with it myself. I wasn't ready to deal with it with everybody else. So I think the passion is there, and I think the emotion is there. It's not the side that Joe wants to let anybody see very often.
Answer my own question, David, but in the last four games, needing their big guys to be there, and he's not the only one who didn't show up. I thought Couture wasn't really, you couldn't really notice him and Marlowe, those guys, but Thornton, no points the last four games. I mean, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know. And it's not just Joe. It's everybody on those top two lines did not produce. And maybe the Kings, they're not crediting the Kings with shutting them down. They're basically acknowledging, you know, we had our chances. We needed to bear down. There were a couple of opportunities. Joe Pavelski had one completely wide open net, and his shot managed to hit Dustin Brown's stick, which is the only thing between the puck and the back of the net. And so there were a lot of times like that. Marlowe had a strong shot in the seventh game when it was still tight that Quick made an incredible save on. So it's, you know, they see enough of the little glimpses of what they're capable of. They aren't ready to sort of, you know, said, you know, we suck. You're not going to get that. But you are going to get a team that it was, I'm guessing, filled with a lot of doubt as that series went on.
David, when it comes to goaltending, we were talking about this right before we had you on. Todd McClellan put Alex Stalock in and then went back to Antti Niemi. Do you think that the combination of Niemi and Stalock is good enough in order for this team to have playoff success?
Yeah, it's a fair question. It's one I'm sure Doug Wilson is going to be asking the team and himself the next 2 weeks. It's success. If you're talking about ultimate success in a Stanley Cup, it's kind of hard to see it with the setup they have now. Niemi did win a Stanley Cup in Chicago. He did have a stronger defense in front of him, of course. Niemi at the top of his game is certainly able to do it, but Niemi's not often, hasn't been at the top of his game as often as he would like or as anybody connected with the Sharks would like this season.
Final question for you, David. You look at this back end, and I've had concerns about it. There's some good players on there just in terms of depth, and I think even top-end guys. You mentioned possibly seeing Dan Boyle exit. We saw without Mark Edward Vlasic, you know, there was a gaping hole there, which is to be expected. I guess two-part question. Is the defense good enough as constructed or without Boyle, even with Boyle, to win the Cup? And a second part of that question, paying Brent Burns that much money, is it possible he goes back to the back end?
I think they need. They know they need to shore up their defense. Scott Hannon and Brad Stewart are both getting a little bit older. Not that they were. Again, I'm not pointing to them as the reason they didn't get anywhere this year. But those are two guys that they. I'm not sure how many minutes they're going to count on. Scott Hannon's contract expires. Frankly, I'd be a little surprised if he's coming back. I think he might be a little surprised too. He said yesterday he just didn't know yet where things how they were going to play out. Brent Burns. You know, as long as McClellan's there, I think he's going to be playing as a forward. The move was made for two reasons. One is that Sharks needed help up front badly a year and a half ago when that was done. And the other was that Burns was coming back from an injury and having a hard time adjusting back on the blue line. He was, I don't know, overthinking or whether he was just getting a little concerned yet about his play there. And he's ended up being a much better forward than he was a defenseman his final year in that position.
David Pollock covers the San Jose Sharks for the San Jose Mercury News. David, thanks very much for joining us this morning. Appreciate your time as always.
You're welcome.
Take care, David. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
We could talk to David for an hour, two hours about this team. Sharks, I mean, sure. What do you used to, you know?
Well, you're up 3-0 and you lose 4 straight. I mean, and you're a team that has cup aspirations.
And I don't want to hear, Boston lost 3-0 and then they came back and the next year and they won the cup. Different thing. Different team.
Different expectations.
Yeah, apples and oranges.
When Boston lost, 4 straight to Philadelphia, I don't think people expected that Boston was going to be a cup juggernaut.
And they also
year.
Didn't have the history of this team choking every year.
That's right.
I mean, I was reading about they've lost only the first round 3 times or whatever it is, second round 4 times, and third round 3 times. Have you seen who they lost in the third round to?
Yeah.
You seen who they lost? They have been the better team in probably 75% of those series.
At the very least, they got to shore up some of the issues they've had, Drew. Whether it's a coaching change or a GM change, they got to make some improvements and learn from this because, it was an epic collapse, as we've said. So it's unfortunate, but that's the way it is.
I don't think it should be a coaching change. I think Doug Wilson has to stop convincing himself that it's just going to change, expecting something different and doing the same thing all the time. It does need to be a player change, but that's a Doug Wilson issue. I think McClellan should keep his job.
That's it for this Saturday morning in the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Big thank you to our guests, George Johnson from the Calgary Herald, Al Strachan, Hockey Hall of Fame journalist and author, and of course, David Pollock from the San Jose Mercury News. In case you missed any of the show, it will be available on iTunes, on TSN1290.ca, and on our website, IllegalCurve.com. Big thank you to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, Linden Market Dental Center, CompuStitch Embroidery Design, and Bernstein's Deli. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/IllegalCurve, and our website with the latest NHL news is IllegalCurve.com. For my colleagues Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg, for producer Tim and producer Remus, I'm your host, Drew Mindell. If it's Saturday, it's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Stay tuned for the Montreal Canadiens and the Boston Bruins.
Listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
Catch the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live Saturdays on TSN 1290 and TSN 1290.ca.